Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And welcome to the Wednesday Night War Review. I'm Adam Wilborn from What Culture, joined by the Dudley Boys of What Culture, Michael Hamflett and Michael Sidgwick, here to review everything that happened on last night's episode of AEW Dynamite. Winter is coming. But before we get into it, if you're a fan of this sort of thing, make sure you subscribe to What Culture Wrestling on either iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts from, for daily wrestling podcasts, where we not only review the Wednesday Night War, and if you want to know our thoughts on NXT, that is available as a podcast right now. We also review Raw, SmackDown. We have interviews, pay-per-views, roundtable discussions, and a roundup of the week, complete with a bloody good quiz, of course, on wrestle culture. As I said, though, joined by Hamflett and Sidgwick to review a very eventful, I mean, effectively, pay-per-view episode of AEW Dynamite. Sidg, have you come down off this evening yet?
No. It was one of those shows that I literally could not stop tweeting afterwards. It just generated so many opinions. It raised the temperature. Still got goosebumps. The hairs are still standing up on my arms, neck, everywhere. Just, I'm kind of worried about this podcast. It's almost daunting to cover everything, to analyze everything, but I'm bang up for it. This should be a good one.
Have you said raise the temperature now? Because what's actually raising the temperature is a giant heater that's yes. placed in the corner of where you're recording that we're not going to know about until the end of the podcast when it actually matters. Yeah, I agree with Cedric. I've said this a lot lately, I think. One of the best Dynamites ever, which you get when you get, like, you know, long-term, well-thought-out, well-plotted, well-mapped-out storytelling, because these episodes should feel like that. You get huge payoffs, you get huge reveals. Ideally, you get twists and shocks and surprises that go down well, which, almost to a man, they did here. It was tremendous. It was, like, a ridiculous 2 and a bit hours of pro wrestling. And, like, I mean this... remark in a complimentary fashion, because we don't always we're not always full of compliments this era. This felt like the best kind of Monday Night Wars era wrestling show rather than Wednesday Night Wars one. The in-ring quality was exceptional, but the cliffhanger, the stuff that they built up to that, all the stuff that then you were able to revisit that kind of made more sense of the cliffhanger after the fact, spoke to just some of the best intricacies of when Raw and Nitro were both operating at peak performance levels.
If you look at everything the show contained, debuts, reveals, twists, high-end match quality, an incredible amount of storyline advancement in one package, in two bookended packages, literally the only thing missing from this show was a great promo, but it was a pay-per-view format, which explains why there isn't a promo. And we've had so many seminal promos building to this main event that you've effectively got them as well. Just, an unbelievable TV show, this.
I don't want to suck the air out of the balloon here, but I've got mixed emotions. On the one hand, it was an amazing episode of AEW Dynamite. On the other hand, it's even more work for us. So I'd like to declare myself... Mike Hamflett, Michael Sidgwick, and all of us here at What Culture Wrestling seem to be recognised as number one on everyone's Spotify Unwrapped for 2021, because we've got so many bloody more podcasts to do, because now we're going to have to cover Impact Wrestling. I'm joking, of course. Yeah, an insanely newsworthy and eventful episode of AEW Dynamite. Let's just dive straight into it. Opening, of course, with that Dynamite Diamond Ring Battle Royale for the beautiful Diamond Ring. And I have to say, we were chatting about before we started recording, the moment this began, Sid, or certainly the moment it started with the little MJF promo going, saying, this isn't just my ring, this is all of the Inner Circle's ring. I thought, why didn't we back MJF? Why didn't I, you know, support my best friend? Because you could sort of see the direction this was going when that happened, Sid.
Indeed. You knew MJF was going to, or the Inner Circle were going to form part of the finish. And you knew, because the genre that is the Battle Royal lends itself very well to telling various stories and subplots. You knew how this was going to go, and yet it was executed so perfectly. Not only did every beat strike, not only did every story beat advance so much, but it never got in the way of itself. It never really felt clumsy or rushed. Everything was left to resonate that needed to. There was so much going on. There were two wrestlers in this ring that have been my absolute low point of this company in 2020. And they both either looked great or did stuff that will inform something great. If it wasn't that action heavy, there was an electrifying sequence at the finish that sort of dragged up to the level of, oh, this is a really good match, as well as a storyline driver. I could not have been any higher on this Battle Royal, and I'll go into specifics when Hamflin's given his thought.
Yeah, this is something that we talked about in advance, Sid, and you were saying that they said it's sort of an annual thing. It's really just sort of a, you know, a means to an end, and they can sort of hoy it on whenever. And yet, Hamflin, this had more storylines going into it and coming off the back of it than half the Royal Rumbles in recent years.
It's the best AEW Battle Royal ever. And the company, outside of that just luscious line in John Moxley's promo, couldn't have paid better tribute to Pat Patterson with it. It was so well booked. I was just so engaged in the quality of this match that I forgot to like think critically about it. And that's been the problem of all the AEW Battle Royals so far, is that something takes you out of it, or the formatting doesn't work, or the experimentation fails, and you're left thinking about the match that you're watching rather than feeling it. And then while you're thinking, somebody does a horrendous botch, or the booking doesn't really make sense, or it doesn't seem to service the key players in the best way. And then you're just thinking and thinking and thinking and thinking, you know, and at the end, it feels like quite a bad time, even if the outcome's interesting or the things that they're going to follow up on are interesting. This was the polar opposite of that. I was drawn in to this match at the very beginning, and I was kept drawn in by so many of the individual moments. I don't want to pull apart all of them ahead of your review, but it brought into focus so many little things that we've seen growing on AEW lately. It brought into focus that John Silver, if you didn't know it already, is over, and it's about time that he becomes a big deal. It brought into focus that the Buckshot Lariat is still the most exciting babyface finish in the game, if and when it's deployed correctly, and one day it's going to be deployed on the new AEW World Champion. To do that at the start of the show and then have you just forget about Hangman Page all over again, I thought was inspired. There was so much to this. This was an abbreviated version, as you say, of a great Royal Rumble. That's what this was, more than it was just a token Battle Royal.
We're going to have to like go between me describing what happened and you reacting to it. But I have to say, there was, and partially it's probably me watching this at a ridiculous time in the morning. And thank Christ I took the Sidgwick strategy of waking up after the show and watching it, because there's no way I would have been able to get to sleep had I watched this live. But I genuinely forgot that Orange Cassidy was still in the match. So when we had that seemingly last elimination, I just thought, hey, that's it. And then was actually, you know, properly surprised when they're like, oh, don't forget about this guy still being in it. And I just love the way that played into it. But let's start right at the beginning. You knew it was going to be good from the moment Matt Hardy just went, right, bye, Isaiah Cassidy, straight away. I'm going to immediately throw to Michael Sidgwick here, because we had John Silver and Alex Reynolds hitting a sort of combo offense on Serpentico. Hangman Page takes advantage, eliminates him. Michael Sidgwick, the floor is yours.
Can I just do a burst of stuff? I can't remember the events as they happen in sequence, so just give us 2 minutes to put it over, then Hamflet will do it, and then we'll move on. Because what I loved about this is Matt Hardy eliminated Isaiah Cassidy, just his protege, to further his dickhead role. He then eliminated both Hangman Page and John Silver, is that correct?
That's right, yeah. He definitely got rid of Page.
So he has eliminated his own protege that he is meant to hold dear, and two of the most endearing baby faces in the match, who we all hold dear, great booking for this new totally hubristic heel who thinks he's invented everything in pro wrestling.
Very quickly, just to jump in there, have you seen his tweet as well?
No.
He tweeted a photo from the what was the football stadium, bollocks? I'm so tired today.
Jacksonville Jaguars ground.
Sorry?
The Jacksonville Jaguars stadium.
Yeah, what was the match called? It's completely escaped.
Stadium Stampede.
Stadium Stampede. He posted a photo of himself with the Young Bucks and Kenny Omega and basically said, you know, when I said I was coming to this company, I was going to elevate young talent. There you go. New tag team champions, new world. welcome.
Absolutely unbelievable. The way they launched into the Buckshot Lariat, like helped by the Dark Order, was just an inspired spot that not only looked really cool, but furthered that storyline. Really, the only thing that didn't hit for me was the Scorpio Sky, Sean Spears interaction. I thought it was too cute and I've already seen very recently a fairly drab match. So that didn't hit, but like literally everything else did. The Sammy Guevara Jungle Boy spot on the apron was like, oh, you cannot dance around then. And then you realize, oh, God damn it, you can, because he's such amazing athletes and pro wrestlers. Me and Wilborn were talking about this before we started the call. The idea of MJF eliminating Jungle Boy, knowing that he would send Sammy Guevara out at the same time, gives him the perfect cause to turn around and say, well, he knew what he was doing, but it's like, I was only trying to eliminate Jungle Boy. I don't know what you're talking about. Gives him the perfect alibi, if you will, for this transgression against the Inner Circle, which again informed the events of later on. It's such a propulsive, episodic, goddamn machine of television.
And take us back to your tweet from, what was it, November? That was what, yes, I was alluding to.
It was my tweet of November 24, 2020, 7:29 p.m. UK time. What if John Silver, this is ahead of the Hangman Page versus John Silver singles match, which again informs everything. What if John Silver tries to ride him like a horsey, which is what he did, because they've bugged my life and I love them for it because I bug theirs. One last thing, and I probably missed loads of things because there was so goddamn much going on. They subverted the baby face is still in. Usually they are caught, or the heel's still in. They are usually caught by a cameraman in this incredible bit of deft booking in a multifariously deft match, this goddamn almost distilled deft. He wasn't caught, Orange Cassidy, by the cameraman. He was caught by Wardlow, displaying the intelligence that a babyface must have to get over as a babyface. What an unbelievable, nuanced, tiny bit of booking that was. All of this was great. I fantasy booked, if you can cast your minds all this way back, last year, the exact final two for this match, because the dynamic's great. The idea of Orange Cassidy just forgetting he has the ring half the time. The fact that he can reach into his pockets and withdraw it. In a subversion of, there was someone I used to work with who was a bit of a perv. He was a married man. And he would, after a couple of pints, he would have his wedding ring on because he was married. And then he would look at some lass, make eye contact with someone, put his hands in his pockets, withdraw it without the ring and go, and waggle his fingers. We're going to get the wholesome White Lodge energy version of that when Orange Cassidy, after being completely decked by a heel, will at some point put his hands in his pockets, reveal that he's got the ring on when he's been wronged, smash someone in the face. There's loads they can do with that. Cassidy versus MJF is a great dynamic. This is an absolute home run.
I marked out, properly marked out at Wardlow spotting that Orange Cassidy was still there. That's not the thing that you're supposed to have this great explosive emotional reaction to. But I was just like, oh my God, Wardlow's a smart, intelligent, like he reined MJF's celebrations in almost to tell him we're not finished yet. Because of course he would, because he's nails and he's brave and he's smart and he's all those things. I thought it was amazing. Miro, right? Miro is like a really class woman's match on Dynamite now, isn't he? Like, look at what he can do. You just need to get the story right. Because his stuff in this was amazing. Like, Miro looked part killer, part hero. He could have took the world on. You can't knock back a guy that'll take everybody in that ring on and look jacked and dangerous and violent and all that sort of stuff. The story's still a mess. The heel babyface alignment is starting to feel a little bit wonky, considering how well he came across in the body and the guts of this match. So there is still stuff to fix. There are still things to address. But what you've got here distilled was what they have in Miro, and I thought that was thrilling too. I feel like we've seen that happen in Battle Royals before, or Royal Rumbles before, or Elimination Chambers, where a guy breaks out in a way that you cannot wait to see more of, and then the company tends not to pounce on that. I hope AEW felt what surely everybody else felt. They agented it to happen, so they knew Miro was capable of it, but he shone in the role too. And I would like to see them just pull way back on whatever it is they're even doing and get serious. Pick a lane with him, because I've never even been the biggest Rusev guy, and there's plenty of Rusev guys out there. But physically here, I found his stuff irresistible, and I wanted so much more of it than what I got.
Getting Miro and Matt Hardy over in the same goddamn match. Jesus Christ, this company rules.
We've gone all over the place here. I'll try and run through what happened as and when it happened. So we had the Hangman Page being ridden like a pony segment. Then Luther gets kicked out, thank goodness. Matt Sydal gets eliminated by Sean Spears onto the ramp. But then Scorpio Sky takes advantage and he eliminates Spears. The two of them hadn't got in the ring early on, whilst everyone else had dived in to start off the match. Then, of course, Spears gets the slug from Tully Blanchard, punches Sky with it. That allows Wardlow to eliminate him. Alex Reynolds gets knocked out by having John Silver thrown into him by Matt Hardy. They then eliminate Silver, as we mentioned, to a huge anti-pap. Paige gets caught a la the Rosebuds and Adam Rose, I suppose. He gets in, Buckshot Lariat, but then Hardy eliminates him. Kip Sabian gets taken out, but as a result of that, he pulls Orange Cassidy out of the ring. Miro leaves under the top rope to continue the beatdown. Miro runs wild. There's a brilliant stare down with Miro and Wardlow when Wardlow does the straps bit. Miro, Jungle Boy, and MJF, Sammy Guevara, and Wardlow are seemingly the final five competitors remaining. They eventually use the numbers game to take out Miro. Wardlow hits him with a lariat, gets eliminated. Jungle Boy and Guevara are dancing around the apron, as we mentioned. Jungle Boy gets shoved off by MJF, but of course takes Sammy Guevara with him. Then Wardlow spots Cassidy. Looks like they're just going to yet again use the numbers game to eliminate Orange Cassidy, but he escapes, hits an orange punch on both of them, eliminates Wardlow. And it will be MJF versus Orange Cassidy next week for the beautiful Diamond Ring. What a start to the show, Sig.
Yeah, just brimming with ideas, logic, creativity, inspiration, which is what a microcosm for the company itself and the form it's in.
Next up, it was Frankie Kazarian versus Chris Jericho. I really enjoyed this match as well. I think Frankie Kazarian has just been really sensational on telly recently. Particularly enjoyed Kazarian rolling out of the way after Jericho went for a lion salt and hitting that springboard leg drop. I don't know why, that just really popped me. He also hit an avalanche flux capacitor for a really good near fall. Kazarian reverses a code breaker into the walls of Jericho. Jericho can't get to the ropes. MJF runs down. There's Hager and Santana and Ortiz at ringside, but MJF runs down with the towel to throw it in like he did for Cody, of course. Sammy Guevara comes down, grabs the towel out of his hands. Jericho escapes, sees Sammy with the towel, and then he exchanges some cradles with Kazarian before hitting the Judas effect out of nowhere for the 1-2-3. Looks like the Inner Circle are just going to celebrate another victory for them this evening when Guevara and MJF get in a big shoving match. Jericho starts effing and jeffing on the microphone and issues an Inner Circle ultimatum. Michael Hamflett, is this the beginning of the end of the Inner Circle?
Maybe. I love the match more than I love the angle, if I'm honest. I love that Chris Jericho, as we kind of touched on last week and in the preview yesterday, is leaning in on the fact that he can still be a pro wrestler first and an entertainer or a comedy act second. That sequence that you described where Kaz goes for the Tomikaze, is it? And then obviously Jericho then tries to block that with the code breaker, to which Kaz blocks and counters himself. Just again, spoke to me that Jericho is trying to remind us that we want to watch him in wrestling matches, that we should be seeing him in wrestling matches again. It gives him authority. It gives him a sense of leadership that he's not had since he had the AEW title over the Inner Circle, the type of leadership that justifies him being the one to lay down the law about the ultimatum next week. I even like what I don't know yet, which is the outcome of the ultimatum. I don't know which way they're going to go with it. Obviously, we've all kind of speculated from the start that this is MJF lifted in the Inner Circle from underneath Chris Jericho's feet, and maybe that's the outcome next week. I'm interested. But it still feels a bit of a mess, I think. This brawl and this discontent didn't feel like it carried over, particularly from the Battle Royal that much or from the Las Vegas stuff the prior weeks. It's a little bit weak for a Jericho angle, but I'm still really, really interested in the ultimatum. So they've got me anyway. I just think the story's been a little bit all over the shop. Match was tremendous. Match was really, really good. Really, really worthy, like, match that you wouldn't expect from Chris Jericho, but shows that he can still do. Kazarian's tremendous. What a valuable asset to this roster he is. I'm not sure if he's ever going to be a world title contender, but not everybody can be. People can serve different purposes, and this was Kaz serving one of his. So it was just a great deal to like here. I just think if you know, this is a bit of critical analysis that we do on these pods. I don't think this Inner Circle's story has been a complete hit.
It's weird. It's like the most intriguing week-to-week episodic, right, you've got me on the hook. Right, you've got me on the hook. Right, again, you get me on the hook every week. By the strictest definition of an episodic pro wrestling storyline, this is unbelievable because it hits every single time that, well, I can't wait to see what happens next. I can't wait to see what happens next. And yet, it's also uneven, as Hamthor points out. The match was really good as a TV match. The story told was so well executed via the actual moves itself, of Kazarian literally having the better of Chris Jericho at every turn. The idea perhaps sprawling over to the idea that he's literally losing a step. There's parallels with the wider storyline of MJF threatening to usurp the Inner Circle for that precise reason. Like, all of this was really, really deft in the match itself and how it mirrored everything else. But there was something about the breakdown at the end that I don't know held water. Like, are they a cohesive unit? Is it all a bit transparent to get to that next week? Is that why the hooks work so well at the expense of this big coherent whole almost? Look, I can't wait to see what they do next week. I also love as well the incredible positioning of Ortiz and Hager not being in that battle royal, loyal by Jericho's side, and the more ambitious players in the Inner Circle of Wardlow and Sammy Guevara wanting to be in that battle royal. They're not quite as loyal to Chris Jericho or this idea of being in the Inner Circle. Just great.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Next up, the Young Bucks were interviewed backstage by Alex Marvez about their forthcoming match with the Hybrid 2. Still a bit of an arsehole by going, hey, do you remember that time we super kicked you? Or one of us super kicked you, and the other one's leg was there. They talked about the fact that they're going to have a match next week, and if they can beat them, that gets a shot at the tag team championships. Then who should appear but the Acclaimed, dropping some dope rhymes on the boys and their new book. TH2 shows up, jump the books, SCU chase them off. What do you know about the Acclaimed, Sidge, and what did you think of this segment?
I know that Anthony Bones is incredibly respected and revered as this prospect that is somehow gone unsigned for as long as he has. From their dark appearances, they are refining an act that is gaining traction. I can't tell how into it I am, if I'm being perfectly honest. I can't tell if Caster's rapping is... He's not as good as John Cena was at it. That's the obvious comparison you're going to make. Doesn't feel
like the books made that. The books made that comparison. Oh, somebody's already done that gimmick. And I was thinking, yeah, somebody's already done that a lot better, I think.
Doesn't ordinarily wear the chain, I don't think. I think that was done on purpose to maybe draw a comparison that you're not meant to think he's that great. He's competent at insulting people, but at the same time being a heel with it. Whereas John Cena was so transcendent in the role that he was like, just, it was untenable him being a heel, because he was just so entertaining. Maybe they are drawing the comparison to hint towards, yeah, you're not meant to think it's that funny or great. Who knows? But they are an inspired pairing. It's good to see them getting on Dynamite within the meritocratic framework that I glow about so regularly. This was fine.
I like the intent of this more than I like the execution of it. I thought all of this was a bit weak, to be honest. But I can't be overly critical of them. I mean, I don't watch Dark, so they're introducing a new team completely cold. I can't be critical of how they've tried to do this, because I know something about the Acclaimed. It's a bit like how I knew a little something about Top Flight, and the key was going to be in the match they had the next week. I don't mind that as a way to introduce a team. It's marginally better than Lights Off, Lights On, oh, it's the Dark Order from last year, or The Butcher and the Blade. You know, this is probably a step up, because we know a little bit about the characters. We know that the Young Bucks begrudgingly respect them enough to give them a match. We know that TH2... want a piece of all of this, that maybe SCU do too. There's something right, and I don't know if this is by design. This is really, really trusting the process. This, we all talked before Full Gear that the Young Bucks and FTR could have well have main evented that pay-per-view, because tag team wrestling can main event shows. Ever since the Bucks have won the titles haven't felt like they belong in the main event. Look at who they're fighting. Look at who they're interacting with. Look at who they're dealing with. I wonder how much of this is going to be presented by FTR as if the Young Bucks are ducking the proper competition. I don't know. Like, if there's something admirable about them wanting to elevate, wanting to do their own version of Cody's TNT title run. It's not a massive criticism, but I don't know. I don't think the division feels as strong at the moment with them holding the belts. And I can't reconcile why that might be. It feels part of a bigger angle than just the Young Bucks are fancying bringing their friends into work matches or bringing young guys into work matches.
Apologies there. I sort of drifted off. The moment you said FTR, I remembered that they've called out the Motor City Machine Guns. So I've been daydreaming about that ever since. But I can say, as a rap connoisseur, the lines about the Young Bucks' dicks were fire. Okay, Britt Baker, Layla Hirsch next. Hey, Layla Hirsch even next. Layla, so good. Got her on her knees early on in this match. we really showcased how good Layla's wrestling skills were. And it was a real showcase, I thought, for Layla Hirsch, this. With Baker needing Rebel's help to really take control here. A lot of submissions in there. Of course, eventually Britt Baker would win via the submission. Before we get into what happened post-match, what do you think of the actual contest, Hamflet?
There's a pattern to these decent AEW women's matches, which is if they start good, they can end great. And I think that's what this one did. There wasn't a great deal of heat for it, but I can't hold the small amount of fans responsible for that, nor AEW, because it wasn't in the quarter hour spot, you know? So there was attempts made to differentiate this from the typical Dynamite women's match. But they got there. They got there with the heat. The match was always good. And then it started approaching something great before, obviously, with it being a short TV match, it never needed to get there. I love Layla Hirsch. I think she's somebody totally different for a division that is still looking for just different characters in the place. In the absence, I've said this before, in the absence of a story, if you've got a diverse roster of characters, then you kind of don't need angles as much, because the angle is in the presentation of this match. You've got Britt Baker, this kind of very polished, almost WWE adjacent women's champion elect, versus Layla Hirsch, a pro wrestling purist, a submission specialist, a Team Taz member in the making, as Cedric pointed out yesterday. So that was the angle, even if there's not really much of an angle. And I bought that, and it fed into the chemistry. Britt Baker feels ready by being able to topple Layla Hirsch with a submission, even if she had a bit of help here and there. Felt super credible. So a couple of minor botches, but nothing that I thought upset the flow of the match. And the Thunder Rosa attack at the end was like full of energy and full of beans. So I thought this was, I don't think it was quite the hit I was hoping for, but it was a modest success at least.
Yeah, the last 2 minutes of this were really, really strong. I think the placement of the advert didn't really help it at all. But the last 2 minutes were really, really good. Layla Hirsch clearly belongs in this division. She's one of the few who's just come out of nowhere, had some very, very commendable performances, and deserves her place. And I think this was consistent with her burgeoning AEW career. One thing I really like this, because I think Hamflet touched on the main points, is Rebel's full embrace of Reba at this point. She didn't want to be acknowledged as Reba for so long, and now she's got written on the back of her jacket. She's a riotous presence on the outside. Like, she's really, really genuinely, earnestly funny. There's a delectable physical chemistry between Baker and Thunder Rosa, and bang up for that match, as functional as it's been built. More small gains, but at this point, are the gains too small?
I just need more Britt Baker on my screen. Rebel took a horrible bump off the back of a Hirsch dive as well at one point. But the story of Hirsch just having control. Reba. Baker, having to use Reba to eventually gain the upper hand, because otherwise she was definitely getting submitted in this. Hirsch gets chucked into the turnbuckle, lockjaw for the submission victory. Then, as we mentioned, Thunder Rosa runs in post-match, gets involved. They brawl, officials separate them. Reba comes in and just cheap shots Thunder Rosa. So Layla Hirsch takes her out with a suplex, and then another brawl. And then agents like Jerry Lynn and BJ Whitmer come down to break it all up. Right, next up, it was my new best friend Darby Allin and Cody Rhodes taking on Team Taz. Particularly enjoyed the moment where Powerhouse Hobbs put a bear hug on Darby Allin, just ragdolled him everywhere. I thought Darby Allin bumping and selling for Hobbs made him look like an absolute monster here. Eventually, Cody tags in, takes control, but Taz hops up on the apron. That allows Ricky Starks to do the eye poke. He eventually takes out Hobbs with a dive. Darby Allin hits a blind tag, coffin drop on Starks for the 1-2-3. But it's all about what happened post-match here. Hobbs comes in, attacks Darby Allin. Arn Anderson gets involved. Team Taz beat him down with a numbers advantage. Dustin Rhodes runs in, but Brian Cage comes out, takes him out with a huge F5. And then they are holding Cody up, allowing Hobbs to yet again twat him with the FTW Championship. When the lights go out, music plays. I'll be honest, I told this decision when we started. The lights that go down, the music plays, and the screen starts spelling out who it is. And I saw the S and went, if this is in Shaq, I'm going to go bonkers here, and not in a good way. But of course, it was Sting in AEW. He comes out, he's got a bat in hand, and he has moments staring down on Anderson, Cody, and in particular, Darby Allin. The crowd went insane for this. How did you react? Oh, so did Renee Paquette, by the way, if you've seen this online. Sting! Sting! How did you react, Sige, to the match and to the surprise debut?
We'll do the match first because it's of considerably less importance and interest. It wasn't as good as the other Cody and Darby Allin versus Team Taz match from, I think, a fortnight ago around that time, which I thought was an awesome TV main event. This wasn't that. There was this minimal interaction between Starks and Allin, which is a disappointment to me because they work so awesome together. But having said that, we'll see it again. This was principally designed to get Powerhouse Hobbs over, and he did. The push-up spot aimed in Cody's direction Hang on. What's that rustling? I can feel. Oh, sorry, it's Michael Hamflett's erection. Just interrupting the audio feed. He flipped him off twice as well. Oh my God. Hey, didn't expect it to be that air big. Darby Allin's so goddamn great. The very spot that you pointed out, the fact that this sort of was vivid to you above all the other moments in the match points out just how phenomenal Darby Allin is. He's selling a bear hug, which is the least exciting move you're going to watch on the state-of-the-art TV program. And yet he sells it like a goddamn invertebrate because he's so phenomenal at being a babyface. So that was really strong. As for Sting, my immediate thought was the goddamn presentation has captured his mystique and the grandeur of the act phenomenally well. The entrance, the video package, was all awesome. The timing of this is awesome because doing it in winter, can you imagine like his face paint coming off in the middle of the Floridian heat in August, which it would have done. The optics, the timing were all so great. The nagging feeling of, I mean, he's just going to be a manager and that's good. He's not going to wrestle. He probably shouldn't wrestle. I'm anxious about him wrestling. Diminished it somewhat. And then this, the wholesome happiness energy of Tony Schiavone was unbelievable. I don't think I've heard a commentator be that earnest. And the fact that commentators have been so robotic for 20 years just illuminated that all the more. There was so much going on with the various connections. What Sting was doing was traveling around the ring physically, but what he was actually doing to just incredible effect was walking around a timeline, a chronology of Dustin Rhodes, of Arn Anderson, with whom he has loads of history, with Cody Rhodes, with a delectable indirect history there, and then all the way to Darby Allin, who he's going to mentor, which traces a line all the way back to Taz. Taz pissed off Darby Allin in QT Marshall's gym in April by saying, the hell did he do in that match with Cody? With Cody, by the way, this is also goddamn deft. And Darby Allin, actually, I know what a goddamn tilt is. It's a difficult thing to escape. I wrestled amateur wrestling in high school. To draw the line between Darby Allin, Taz and Sting, all the way around that, it's just incredible book and incredible presentation, incredible moment. And I got a little bit emotional watching this because there's 1,000 fans in there. They're all distanced and at the right times, because it was a similar thing to Full Gear, they will bring the noise and it's electrifying. This was an actual monster pop in 2020 after everything got shut down. I got emotional, like wrestling came back a little bit.
Yeah, much the same, actually. That popped huge for it. And then I think one of the reasons once I came down was because I realised that there was noise and it was greeted with what major wrestling moments and surprises should be greeted with. I love this end-to-end. I should say, I mean, from the Sting stuff, I wasn't a big fan of the match. I thought they underthought the match and it felt like they'd done that on purpose because they knew what was coming. It's almost like they could kind of get away with not giving this one too much thought, not as much as they normally would. And I didn't love that Team Taz lost, if I'm honest. I think Cody was in a position probably to be able to take a pin, but I get it for the attack sequence and all that sort of stuff. So you can be a bit gentle on that. Sting stuff was amazing. Sting stuff was absolutely amazing. They didn't just tap in, as Sidgwick points out, to all the things that would potentially ruin a Sting return in 2020, such as the heat peeling the paint off, or too much physicality revealing that there's a 61-year-old man under that timeless look that Sting's got. You know, it's a bit like when Rey Mysterio hobbles a little bit and you remember there's a 40-plus guy with no knees working under the mask. You want to see him as a timeless character, and Sting can be just that, using the right role. This was a mirroring of everything that WCW got right with Sting when they first introduced the Crow character. He would appear on the scene and he would point his bat at the NWO. He would point his bat at the baby faces. He would be dressed in the colours of the NWO. But whose side is he on? Well, he's on no one's side. He's on Sting's side. And that was where the drama was. He was an enigma that he brought with him, a sense of danger, but a sense of experience and wisdom that everyone else in his presence didn't have. Sting was the man that held the cards. He was the one you wanted to be on the side of, even if you don't know what side he's on. Of course, he was presented as a babyface here, but he allowed all those looks to linger in such a way that you, as kind of Sidgwick as a leader, really, like, were there to ask the questions of what all those interpersonal relationships meant as he went and stared all those individuals in the ring with which there was some history with some and none with others, but implied. As good a presentation of Sting as AEW could have pulled off, not least considering the Global Bastard circumstances too, this would have been exactly as I would have done it in a full arena.
Hmm.
And just mesmerizing. Like, when you, I understand why the USA Network bollocks Vince McMahon and tells him to bring 40 legends back for a Raw, because they are magic. Like, they are they are heroes. They have a gloss around them that your rank and files don't, and you want one day for those rank and files to have. And that's what, like, and that's what's so annoying about seeing so many of them misused by WWE as they are now. This was just magnificent use of one of the best out there.
Did it annoy you, the social media reaction from certain areas about, oh, well, if WWE did this like they did with Goldberg, then you wouldn't be saying this is so good? Or is that just mutants being mutants and trying to pick holes in anything? Because, like you said, the general consensus appears to be he's probably going to be involved in a managerial role, like they've got loads of other legends doing. And even if he does wrestle, it's not like he's probably going to be taking anyone else's spot, potentially.
WWE did do it. For a start, they did it so well originally that I was into it, and then they bollocks it up. Well, that's my thoughts on that. Like, I've always tell this to Hamflet when I'm mourning my lot is, God, why do I have to watch WWE? Well, the stress and the bloody duress it causes me. I always, because I've revisited Sting's career extensively. I bought, they did a 3-disc Clash of the Champions DVD. And they released it in 2012 when they used to do 3-disc DVDs. And that was when I first watched Sting versus Flair from Clash of Champions. I just fell in love with the character, his connection with the crowd, the athletic skill on him. One of the most underrated actual in-ring pro wrestling talents ever, for being able to, like, psychology and athleticism in that broad role. Unbelievable. I've got such affection for Sting. But more, I'm more nostalgic for the Surfer Sting character, even though I never lived through the nostalgia, if that makes any sense whatsoever. WWE did do it. They botched it. The difference between AEW and WWE is that, one, they nailed this presentation better than I think they did with Sting at Survivor Series, a bit, if I'm being honest. And they will just use him so well and so sparingly. Got no doubt about it whatsoever.
I want to say, Sidgwick, I'm really glad that you picked Hogan and Warrior over Sting in 1990. Because if you hadn't have done, it had got to 2001 and, like millions of people, you'd have left and never come back and we'd have never worked together. So,
WCW just looks so cheap. I got fed pilled. That's how they do it, you know. They think, like, it's so enormous and beautiful looking, or at least it used to be, that everything else has to be, like, rinky-dink. That's how they got you. That's how they get people. Not through its quality.
Like, WCW's figures were too rubbish, weren't they?
Yeah, the figures were rubbish.
That sort of stuff doesn't help when you're five. Like,
yeah, it just looked like a leisure centre. It was like the leisure centre fake Undertaker, WCW, and then the Fed.
The worst part of last night's show came next. Dreadful backstage interview with Hikaru Shida. Alex Marvez talking about Abaddon. She's going to be in action next week. There's a noise. Hikaru Shida says, oh, can we take it again? Alex Marvez says, we're live, pal.
Should have.
Believe that one, didn't he?
And then she left. Awful, this. But, I mean, if this was the worst part of the show, not all bad, I suppose, Sig.
Well, it lasted 30 seconds, yeah. Which, again, is probably worse than the execution and the concept behind this emerging storyline. Rubbish. Absolutely rubbish. Your champion should not be scared. Your babyface champion, especially, should not be scared. They wouldn't dream of running anything like this with Jon Moxley. It just brings into focus how shocking this is on Hikaru Shida. Like, it's pure Shan, to use the Geordie expression. It's proper Shan on Shida, this.
My thoughts exactly, yeah. I wouldn't even say, you don't even need to go to Jon Moxley. Just go to the mid-card of the men's division and upwards, and they probably wouldn't book a male in this position. So the intent was to make Abaddon scary. You've done it. And you did it sort of effectively. I don't think Shida looked half as weak as a lot of people did when Abaddon appeared on the ramp as the next challenger. And, you know, Shida was battle-worn from a match and probably a bit rattled by who was next. And, oh my word, Abaddon's a bit unpredictable. she shouldn't now be walking around being spooked. There are other ways to get across that Abaddon is a frightening presence than have Hikaru Shida be the one to sell in a door rattling in the background. Like a big miss, this one. And yeah, like I couldn't understand how Alex Marvez didn't stick the landing there.
Yeah.
It felt like that was what this was set up for. And they actually shot it live, pal. And he blew his moment.
Instead, we got another promo, brilliant promo from Moxley, setting up the main event, of course. Talked about how far he and AEW have come. Talked about how he and Omega have been on collision course their whole lives as the two best wrestlers in the world. The stakes couldn't be higher and the fans will go banana. Lovely little nod to Pat Patterson, I thought that, Sige.
Yeah, really, really nice. A great promo. He's eating banana on the podcast like a complete dickhead that he is. You listeners out there have got no idea what we have to put up with.
Missed my Eric Clapton reference earlier, so I thought I'd just do that.
Adam Wilbon is the man that does prop comedy on an audio medium.
Absolute bumbling dickweed. tumbling dickweed. Nah, I love him. I love him.
Yeah, really nice.
I also hate him because I'm thrown off track. I can't even remember what Moxley said. That's good. What did he say?
What he did was, and you know, they've earned this, but he went big on this being a legacy feud. There was obviously the foreshadowing that this wouldn't be the end because nothing will be the end because these two forces coming together and they're just always going to be the pillars of AEW and pro wrestling. That idea that, like, it's kind of Wilbon alluded to, that sort of, you know, it's always been about us, as if their backgrounds could have been any more different. You know, like, has Moxley come from this pit in Cincinnati and just like fought in CZW and in death matches and gone through the WWE system? Kenny Omega saw that system and thought, absolutely no thanks, mate, and went the totally opposite route.
Kenny Ambrose.
did every single thing different, but Moxley made you believe, as has the video packages and as has the booking, that these two were sort of destined to find a way together.
I don't want to get ahead of ourselves and
spoil. The Highlander imagery as well. That was cool. Only Moxley can
do. Yeah. Again, how does he get away with those? It's him, isn't it? It's his charisma.
Rad.
I don't want to get ahead of ourselves and sort of spoil the ending, but Sige, wasn't it nice to have Don Callis on commentary and not have the dancing girls for Omega's entrance? We'll go through bit by bit, but just your thoughts on that, first of all.
John Moxley specifically requested, in particular, don't bring the bells and whistles. Sick of the smoke and mirrors. I know what you're trying to do. Do what you're asking of me. Don't bring the dancing broom girls. Just bring yourself and bring a goddamn fight. And Kenny Omega did not, in fact, bring out the dancing broom girls. They were conspicuous but very subtle by their absence because he further wanted to create the idea, drawing Moxley into the competitive sportsman-like AEW world title match. That motherfucker had no intention of wrestling. Incredible touch. They've built this Don Callis thing so goddamn well. Hamflet, no, we'll do it at the end. Yeah. Go through the match because I feel like this is going to be a bit formless, but all the better for it.
Okay. I'd also like to note, Moxley literally entered from the place where he got attacked 2 weeks ago. So they have the match. I'm not going to do it justice. Go and watch it and then come back and listen to this review if you haven't seen it yet. Omega at one point surprised Moxley with a dragon screw, then starts targeting his knee, Katara Crusher, chucking him into the barricade, etc., etc. Omega hits a dive, but Moxley cuts off a springboard, hits the paradigm shift in the ring, doesn't cover him. Commentator's going bonkers, wondering what he's doing, goes under the ring, hoists a couple of chairs in there, no idea what's going on, but he sets the chairs up as seats and invites Omega to sit across from him. And let's just slap each other. Let's just hit each other as hard as we can. As Hamflet brilliantly alluded to on Twitter, Omega brought a V-trigger to a fist fight. They trade strikes. Lots of V-triggers in and around this. I'm not going to be able to mention them all. Moxley hits a German suplex. Omega hits a knee strike. Moxley hits a lariat. He gets a two count off another paradigm shift. Numerous occasions, Moxley fights out of the one-winged angel. Omega fights out of the paradigm shift and hits a bloody Okada drop kick and does the pose. Out on the floor, paradigm shift into the heater, hearing the stories about how awful the conditions must have been in Daly's place. really came into stark contrast when I saw an actual heater at ringside. A medical official comes down. Don Callis gets concerned about Omega. Moxley doesn't care, gets rid of everyone, ground and pound. Don Callis comes down, got a microphone. He wants to get on the mic, he wants to explain to the referee, and explain to everyone, wants to get Omega checked. They're not sure if he can continue, etc. Moxley lays him out in the midst of all this. Callis drops the microphone. Omega grabs it, twats John Moxley with it. He's busted wide open. All the V-triggers you want. One Winged Angel, 1, 2, 3. Kenny Omega is your new AEW World Champion. And as if that was not enough, Omega celebrates for about 5 seconds holding the belt up in the ring before he is led away by Don Callis. Everyone's up in arms about what's happened, about the fact that shenanigans have occurred in this, as Sidgwick mentioned, this supposedly gentleman's contest for the world title. They're running through the back, they're running past people who are trying to find out what's going on, trying to stop them, trying to question what they've just witnessed. Alex Marvez catches up to them just as they're about to dive in a car and hightail out of there. Don Callis says, "We'll explain everything next Tuesday." To which Marvez says, "Next Tuesday, but Dynamite's on a Wednesday." Don Callis said, "Yes, Dynamite's on a Wednesday, but Impact Wrestling is on a Tuesday on Access TV." And what a spectacular ending to the show. What a tease. And what more work do they want us to bloody do, Michael Sidgwick?
Oh, gee, I don't know where to start with this.
I'm nervous about this. How can we do all this justice?
Yeah.
I don't know where to start with this. Right. If I'm going to get one criticism out of the way, actually. I don't think it was aimless, because I think it fit into what I thought was a structural masterclass. I do think it took, for TV, right? If this is a pay-per-view, I don't think I'd have any such concerns. For TV, I think it maybe took a while to get going. But my read on the match is this. Kenny Omega comes out, there's no Broom Girls. Don Callis is on commentary because it's an established thing that would already happen. Not in AEW canon, but in New Japan canon, which is why it is in AEW canon.
It is an AEW canon. He commentated on Page and Omega. They deserve.
That's what I said, eh?
I thought you meant that it was only like because we know it from New Japan, but I thought that was fantastic. That, like...
No, but like that's the level that Kenny Omega is on. He's an absolute genius. So they do a lot of outside brawling. Referee is lenient, it's at his discretion. The idea is that John Moxley has to do this because that's all he is. This leads to his advantage because he's better on the outside. And he drops Kenny Omega with the paradigm shift. At this moment, it becomes transcendent and it's brilliant because he doesn't go for the pin. He goes outside. And I'm thinking, oh, that's really weird. That's what they're doing. And then it all becomes so wonderfully clear. When he grabs those chairs, what they're doing here is they never had the face-to-face contract signing. Either Moxie got jumped or he jumped Kenny Omega. What they do with this chair sequence is just restore parity, staring into each other's souls, as was said on the voice over of the road to winter is coming, and instantly parity's there in agreement. We're sitting on the same chairs, we're looking at each other. I've done my thing, you did your thing before the match. This is where the real story that we've promised one another starts. We're going to sit down and we're going to leather each other in the face, and then that's where the match starts. And that's in fact where the match did explode into the brilliance that we were always expecting, that was actually advertised. Like some of the action that Wilborn, you actually did a very good job of outlining, was unbelievable. I think the only thing that you didn't mention was that unbelievable V-trigger counter to John Moxley's suicide dive, which dare I say...
Oh, God, yeah.
Dare I say this, right? I've done quite a bit of disrespecting sacred New Japan Pro Wrestling canon of late. I think this was better than the V-trigger counter to Okada at Dominion 2018. The physical timing on this was so unbelievable. He could have whiffed it or concussed him if it was a centimeter wrong. Unfriggin' believable. So you get the story told so eloquently, told with such visual poetry. You get the match, which is just unbelievable. And then you get a finish that is going to prove divisive. That is not typically what you'd expect from an AEW world title match. This has so much unbelievable dramatic gravity because it never happens. It feels like a transgression. It feels like something you should be earnestly pissed off at because your babyface hero has just been screwed by American wrestling shenanigans, which Kenny Omega's been talking about. Oh, the Kenny Omega from New Japan, he's coming back, he's coming back. And he did. Not the best bounce machine, not this babyface who won the world title at Dominion in the greatest match of all time. The Bullet Club Kenny Omega, the dickhead who lies. He wasn't wrong. Like, he absolutely wasn't wrong. What an unbelievable sequence of pro wrestling television. 40 exhilarating minutes, five of which I felt could have been sharpened up, if I'm being honest. Just phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. Hamflet, here's how we'll do it. You talk through the amazing parallel to All Out, which you spotted. Then I, on the back of your idea, figured out the one wonky beat isn't actually wonky at all. Yeah. And then you do the match, okay?
Okay, I can go for that. Because I want to get my one criticism in, because then I want to just be all about praise, because I just feel like I want to get out of the way. If I'm being totally honest, I don't know if it was because it was a microphone, but at least it was logical. My earnest, Mox was done dirty feeling wasn't quite as heightened as I think they probably would have wanted it to be. And I don't know whether or not if you replace a steel chair with a microphone, that does that. Something about the execution of that finish, not the layout of it, just the execution of it, didn't quite hit for me as
much.
The V-triggers absolutely helped, yeah. But I understood the need for speed and all of that. And yeah, the identical shooting of Kenny Omega and Don Callis leaving Daly's place down the exact same path Kenny Omega left Daly's place at All Out when he just lost a title, when he seemingly lost everything. And he turned to the Young Bucks, and even they, who themselves had appeared to have turned heel, couldn't understand what Kenny was on about. And he said, I'm going to clean things up, because that was the little nod for the people that knew and the people that wanted to know that he was going to become the cleaner. Ultimately, it was a promise from Kenny that enough was enough. All this Hangman Page stuff, all this tag stuff was farting around. And if this was rock bottom, he was going to fix that right away. And he was going to fix it in seismic fashion. For them to mirror that in how he fixes it, I thought was just special. Special, special stuff. Not a callback for callback's sake. Far from that. The Young Bucks stopped Kenny right by the car in the same way that Alex Marvez stopped Kenny and Don Callis right by the car. But the differences this time were so sharp and so stark. What has Kenny Omega done to arrive at those seismic changes? Holy, he's rang his friend and he's sold out to another wrestling organization to get what he wanted. What has Kenny Omega done? We've seen like the way in which they, like the mirroring of those two shots, I thought was just impeccable.
This Elite storyline has been so intricate. I'm on record as saying it's one of the, it's the best thing I think I've ever seen in pro wrestling booking. I mentioned last week, they arrive at the position where Hangman Page is with the Dark Order at the exact same time the Bucks and Omega are now holding gold. To get to that position and like do the quality and do the work within the respective divisions is just unbelievable. There was literally one moment that everyone was a bit like, nah, I don't really get that. And Hamflet pointed out on Twitter at the time, and I absolutely did not have an answer for it. And if I did, it was probably a reach because I was so into the storyline. He said, I don't get why the Bucks, who, if anything, would have a disagreement with Hangman Page, took Page's side and were a bit put out by Kenny Omega's behavior following All Out. Something didn't match up there. And I don't know, I can't recall what I said at all, but I don't think it explained it at all. This did. In unbelievable fashion. Just when you think they've done one flub and it kind of got glossed over. No, it's informed this earth-shattering goddamn storyline development. Hamflet, floor's yours.
I just love that match. So I was watching live and, you know, the objective was achieved, regardless of what you think of Impact Wrestling, regardless of how the finish might have gone down for some, the objective was absolutely achieved because the buzz was absolutely huge. We talk a lot about Twitter being one of the only, or, you know, online, I guess, being one of the only metrics with which to judge how a wrestling show has gone down. The buzz was absolutely enormous. People wanted more. People were tweeting as just like a matter of public service where they could watch Impact for those that were asking the question.
The website.
Like, the reception for it was, like, felt immediate. Like, wrestling felt immediate. So it was a total success from what I could see. And yet, like, I felt a bit of a bore because I was feeling like, God, what a great match that was. What an absolutely fabulous match that was. The longer I've had to think about it, the more I think I've worked out what it was I loved so much. There is a, and I've found this difficult in the past when people reach out to us and ask for recommendations of how to watch New Japan. I think Kenny Omega and Kazuchika Okada at Wrestle Kingdom, Omega Okada 1 is a good primer for how to understand and enjoy New Japan style matches psychologically. I think Kenny Omega versus John Moxley might be an even better one. This felt like a New Japan match as presented to an American television audience. And I can't think of a higher compliment to pay that. A Kenny Omega New Japan match, no less. The slow build is often a feature of these dramatic New Japan main events, but it always means something. It always matters. You know, listen to What Culture Wrestling podcast, because we previewed this to the letter yesterday. Moxley's counter game, particularly in moves where Kenny Omega was trying to haul him above his head, he countered them every single time. It was only on the last one, I think, when Excalibur said something like, maybe he can counter the one-winged angel. But prior to that, every other counter was just there for you to pick up if you wanted to pick that up. It wasn't buried, it wasn't hidden, but it was there and it mattered. I don't think it was cold in Daly's place. I've been to Florida in November twice and I don't think it was cold all day. I think AEW went to the trouble for 1 hour and 55 minutes of telling us how cold it was because you had to justify a piece of equipment that shouldn't be there, like a heater. And by the way, if Kenny Omega gets a giant associate who ends up being his heater, that's going to be another inspired touch. But you have to justify why there's something as absurd as a heater at ringside when these two men have gone through such violence against one another before. It's really hard to find a weapon at ringside when one guy's been DDT'd through a glass table or another guy made a bed of barbed wire. You know, think of the weapons, things that these two have done to each other. A heater doesn't exist in a pro wrestling context. Even when a barbed wire bed does, a massive fan heater doesn't. So you have to tell your audience for 1 hour and 55 minutes that it's freezing in Florida, a place that's known for being cold.
It was cold for them.
Yeah, I know cold to them. You know what I mean?
It wasn't minus, was it?
44 degrees Fahrenheit in England and we'd be walking out in shorts and t-shirt. So it's really hard for us as an audience to be like, oh, it must be nightmare for these wrestlers physically working out. How are they going to stay warm? That's why there was a heater like there at ringside. Love the logic. Callis commentating Hangman Page, Kenny Omega a month ago. It's also what this would have needed and what would have been right for criticism had it not been inserted. Tony Khan in kayfabe left the front door wide open for Don Callis, because why should you believe that there's anything wrong with that? He turned up at full gear and he did an excellent job commentating on his friend's match. He wasn't even that biased. It was just a nice sort of, you know, extension of a handshake and nothing more. And now look what's happened. Like, Callis has bit the hand that has fed him. So I thought that was absolutely fantastic. The work itself in the match was so thorough. The details were so thorough. How it didn't betray the styles of either man, I think, is a minor miracle, because you kind of watch that and it makes you realize how far apart John Moxley and Kenny Omega are and how they build their epics. It didn't occur to me until towards the end of how much of a styles clash this could have been. And I don't think it was. If anything, it was the total opposite. Moxley drew the mean-spirited violence out of Omega with the V-trigger to a fist fight. Kenny Omega drew the counter-wrestling out of Moxley, because a year ago, Kenny Omega took the piss out of Moxley for trying to go and win a G1. Kenny Omega should have been watching, because if he had watched, he'd have known that John Moxley can do it all, just like he can. And I thought all of that was, you know, it was all the implication rather than what you actually saw within the match, but it was there if you wanted it. And if you didn't pick up on those beats, there was absolutely loads there for you to enjoy as just a standard, as if these two had never interacted before, as if there'd been no story. You're still watching an absolutely tremendous 4+ star television main event for a top title between two proper stars.
I don't get the reaction as well. Some people are saying, well, it wasn't match of the year. Well, it wasn't match of the year, because the match of the year happened on February 29th, and we all know that. But anyway, the fact is, it was a great match.
I mean, is that the bar, though? Is that what we're saying now?
No, what I'm saying I took it as, I didn't go into this thinking this was going to be match of the year, because we all knew. Like, I mean, talk about, you know, making something good out of a situation that I rolled my eyes at. The moment I remember speaking to Sige the day after, they went, right, it's going to be Moxley and Omega on free TV for the title. And I was like, why have they done that? Like, do it at Revolution. Like, there might even be like loads of fans there. Now you've effectively potentially got a rematch. Obviously, it's a long way to go. They might choose to go in a different direction, but you've got a rematch, the rubber match, as Sid sort of explained to me and to everyone when we talked about this on the podcast, with the sort of thing of, look at what they did when they knew they had to wrestle with another match coming, and they've left so much like in the bank, but still, you know, they didn't use it. Like when he hit the One Winged Angel, I didn't think, I wonder if he's going to kick out here. I was like, well, that's that, you know, they've got that in saved, and, you know, might not want to do that. Like you say, Sid, they might want to give that to Hangman or just not do it whatsoever. So you've got that, and you've just got, so you've got all the callback spots. I just, yeah, I thought it was sensational. And Sid, turns out when Tony Khan says, oh, yeah, it's going to be a seismic shift, he wasn't bloody lying, was he?
I wish he hadn't said tonight. He knew this was coming, but he said tonight it will shift. He should have said over the coming weeks.
Yeah.
If anything else, he's bought himself a get-out-of-jail card because he didn't specify it. So he was right and he was wrong at the same time. This was a classic. It was a classic all the better for the TV format. What a goddamn cliffhanger this was. I can't think of a better one in years and years and years. And it was the ball around a TV classic main event. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. We both have minor criticisms of the match. I know Andy Murray didn't like it that much. But even Andy Murray will tell you, he's talking about, it's always going to be in the 4-star plus region. It's just whether you felt it. You can appreciate, oh yeah, it was 4-star. I just didn't really like it that much. Or I felt it. It was amazing. We're talking like, oh, it's not Okada Omega. Well, no, it wasn't, because Okada Omega is on this complete and utter different plane of goddamn reality. It's a classic TV main event with just one of the best TV endings ever. No complaints.
Okay. Yeah, so just like, again, like I get with people as well. Like this did what all the great matches in this era do, which is A, make you forget there's no audience, and then B, remind you when they actually draw that noise. R was getting the butterflies and the stirrings at the end of this. So the Okada Omega comparison is tough, even when you've got a full crowd, let alone in the virtually empty Daly's place. And I don't think that's us making excuses for it either. You know, the impact stuff, right, as well. Something that I'll forget loads of stuff. I'll be kicking myself after this. We've recorded this, the things that I wanted to mention. But I tweeted this as well. God damn the booking, man, of setting up a whodunit. And then it turned out that Kenny Omega could have about 50 different accomplices in another part of Florida. Holy, that's incredible. That is absolutely incredible. We had it down as one man, and we were permitted to fantasy book ourselves into thinking it was somebody from another wrestling company. And that was why that was interesting. That was why that was wild. Kenta, but he works from New Japan. Now it's who knows who, and they could work for Impact Wrestling. And that's assuming rock, it's not Hangman Page.
Rock, sham, rock.
You know,
sham,
like
rock, sham, rock.
That's assuming it's not Hangman Page. That's assuming that Kenny Omega isn't the figurehead of a new Four Horsemen stable. It's, you know, like, oh my God. Again, one more tiny criticism, because I just cannot fathom for the life of me why they did it, unless the first sign of AEW working with Impact is that AEW looks a bit like Impact, is Eddie Kingston crashing the broadcast at the end to shout, Archer! That was so unbelievably TNA. I was like, oh wow, did like Don Callis have a bit of input backstage as well? Because I cannot fathom why that was what we saw. That was what we heard over the shot of Moxley left confused and beaten in the center of the ring. That was kind of a disaster. And it speaks to the success of this angle that there hasn't been like a tidal wave of criticism towards him for it.
Yeah, that was bizarre. But again, why labor on it? It's unfair. Yeah,
it is.
I didn't do the vote on Twitter because I very nearly put who won the Wednesday Night War? NXT, AEW, or Impact Bloody Wrestling? Because like you say, we've got this explosion of excitement around this. And I kid, of course, then we say, oh, bloody hell. It's a hard life, isn't it, having to watch more bloody wrestling for this job. Do we even need to bother asking who won the Wednesday Night War?
No. AEW won the Wednesday Night War. It's one of the best episodes of television I've ever seen.
Totally.
I won't put wrestling in front of that at all. NXT was pretty good in places for me.
Yeah, it was. This is the mad thing, isn't it? Like, it wasn't a bad week for NXT. This is not one of those weeks where AEW's hammered it because they've got bad opposition. But yeah, that was a sublime wrestling show.
Like you alluded to, Hamlet. It's actually really quite a good episode of NXT with a spectacular promo from Pat McAfee again, which we'll go into our NXT review. But no one's going to be talking about that for the next week.
Yeah, who cares? Like, who cares today? Like, a worst case scenario for a go home show. But you're not to feel sympathy because they put themselves in this position.
Well, I can't get over. I realise that we all woke up. Well, you so watch it live, you idiot.
Yes, I did. I'm not going to refute the idiot bit. I did. It took me about an hour and 45 minutes to get to sleep to try and get a couple of extra hours. So,
an hour and 45 minutes to get sleep for an hour and 45 minutes.
Yeah, pretty much. But
having said all this, we should all just move to America and make things far more easy on all of us. I feel like when work finishes today, I'm probably just going to go back and re-watch that final sort of 45 minutes, Sige.
Yeah, I'm going to watch it from Sting's entrance onwards. It's my plan for tonight.
Amazing. Well, winter certainly did come. It wasn't the only one. Let us know your thoughts on AEW Dynamite on Twitter at WhatCultureWWE. Of course, watch. They can follow all three of us. You can follow Michael Hamflett at
Michael Hamflett.
Follow Michael Sidgwick at
M. Sidgwick.
Follow me at Adam Wilburn. Follow us all at WhatCultureWWE. As I said, make sure you subscribe to What Culture Wrestling, where, yes, we will be reviewing that other show that just so happened to happen last night. The other one, NXT, in due course. Of course, AEW clear winner, Petey McPickle. It's a landslide this week for the vote. And no doubt over the weekend, well, not only will myself and Hamflett be previewing War Games and reviewing War Games, in fact, in the small hours of Monday morning, but certainly we're not going to struggle to have something to talk about over the weekend between me and Michael Sidgwick. So make sure you subscribe to What Culture Wrestling for that one. But this has been the Wednesday Night War review of AEW Dynamite. Winter is coming. My thanks to the Dudley Boys. Thank you for joining us. And we'll see you soon.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.